We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Law Talk right here, WTIC News Talk 1080. Glad to be with you. I am Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and we're fitting in here, as we usually do on Saturdays, right after Dr. Alessi and right before Pet Talk. We're here from today, from right now, until 1 o'clock today. This program is your legal interactive toolbox. We do this as a public service. We provide legal information that we hope you will find to be interesting, especially helpful. That would be great. And once in a while, maybe a little bit entertaining also. This program's a little bit different. Well, why is that? It's because due to a scheduling issue, it had to be pre-recorded. The only difference is we're unable to take phone calls, but stick with us because Saturdays going forward, that's not the case. What we do have for you is a whole set of carefully curated topics, fresh from the news. Some of them are going to help you do things legally. Some of them are going to help you understand things legally. So stick with us. We're delighted to have you aboard. And I'd like to give you a little bit of an idea of a rundown of what we're going to be covering today. Okay. First up, how to enforce a settlement agreement. And we've got a vignette that we're going to play out for you with a couple of characters here. It shows what happens when you reach an agreement and maybe you withdraw your lawsuit, and then all of a sudden, the other side does not do what they agreed to do. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about something that comes up in our private practice periodically. It's called vexatious litigation. Somebody sues someone else and loses. The other party wants to sue them back, typically looking for their expenses and so on. There's a couple of twists in it. And if you or anybody you know has ever found yourself in that situation, listen up, because there's a couple of things you need to know here. After that, we're going to journey over to the world of probate, the topic, where's the will? And in particular, why does it matter if the original will is missing? I mean, everybody's got photocopies these days, right? Well, there's a surprise in that, and we'll tell you what the surprise is and how you can work around it. Going from there, we're going to talk about something else that's related. It has to do with the topic of buying an asset from a decedent's estate and the tricks involved and maybe a little bit of tax consequences and how to make sure that things turn out the way that you expect they will. Finally, we've got jointly owned bank accounts. There's some advantages. There's a lot of things people don't realize. Some folks figure it's a good way to avoid having to deal with probate. Doesn't work. But there's some downside risks you need to know about, especially if you're thinking of adding a child's name or a relative's name to a bank account so as to, well, make it easier to help me with my bills. So we're going to be doing all of that, and we'll be doing that right up until 1 o'clock today. So starting off about enforcing a settlement agreements, here is our story, okay? Peter sues David. They have a lengthy fight in court. Doesn't matter what it's about. Peter wants $75,000. on the very eve of trial. Their lawyers and the two of them are at court on some matters. They reach an agreement. David's going to pay Peter $25,000 in 30 days and another $25,000 in 60 days, and that is going to be in full and final satisfaction of Peter's claim. The judge is on the bench. She canvasses both parties to make sure that they understand the terms, that they agreed to them voluntarily. She then approves the agreement in open court. She tells Peter to withdraw his case. After all, it's now settled. Well, David pays the first $25,000 as agreed. When the second $25 is due, David doesn't pay. Peter is enraged. He wants to reopen the case, and he wants to go to trial for the full $75,000. Why does he want to do that? Because he took a haircut in return for the expense of avoiding the trial, and now he hasn't even been paid the agreed upon amount. Okay? Meanwhile, David says, nope, maybe I made an agreement, but you're not going to be able to get more than I agreed to, even though I breached it. You're limited to the amount set forth in the agreement. Okay, so who is correct? Well, this is a case that lawyers deal with from time to time, but it's important that the rest of us know about it also. This goes back to a Supreme Court decision called Audubon Parking Associates versus Barkley and Stubbs. Now, this didn't have anything to do with parking. It had to do with collecting money that was due and owing. And in that case, the numbers were somewhat similar. The parties agreed to settle the amount for $50,000. There was partial payment. The party who was looking for more money said, hey, I took a haircut here. I want the right to have a trial for the full amount. And as a result, the court had to conduct a hearing on it. Somebody was dissatisfied with the result. There was an appeal, and the Supreme Court addressed that. So let me tell you, Bruce, basically, first of all, who wins in our case. Does Peter win? He wants a trial, and he wants to go after the full 75 grand. Or does David win? David says, yeah, he agreed to take 50. I agreed to pay 50. I breached the agreement, but he's still limited to the 50. So the Supreme Court says David wins, okay? They're limited to 50. But on the other hand, Peter doesn't need to go to a trial to get that. We're going to enter a judgment for him for that amount right now. So what's going on here? Well, here's what the court says, okay? That settlement agreement that they reached in which they were resolving these issues, the court has the inherent power to enforce summarily that agreement as long as the terms were clear and unambiguous, okay? That settlement agreement was an agreement to end a lawsuit. It's a contract, and sometimes it's enforceable in a subsequent different lawsuit labeled a breach of contract lawsuit. But the court goes to lengths to point out in many situations it's enforceable by the entry of a judgment in the original suit, okay? The key element regard to the settlement was that there was no factual dispute as to the terms of the agreement, okay? So what this does is it reflects a delicate balance. On the one hand, the court's balancing judicial economy, not having to go to a trial on a case that the parties had an agreement on. But on the other hand, they're balancing it with the parties' constitutional rights to a jury and to a trial on the other hand. This is the balance. That is the rule. So what's the takeaway for all of us who are sitting on the sidelines if we find ourselves in this position? Number one, make sure that if you're going to have a settlement agreement, you want it to be clear and ambiguous so that there's no attack on that later. That way the court can enforce it. Number two, if it's in connection with pending litigation, it is even better if it's done in court and the court has the opportunity to canvass both sides and then approve it. Because at that point, it deprives either side of the opportunity to claim, well, I didn't understand it, I was hurried into it. The court will always say, do either one of you have any questions of me? So that's the takeaway on that one. If you're going to enter into an agreement like that and then you renege on the agreement for whatever reason, well, not a good idea. The other party simply has to go to court, and if they can prove the agreement, they can prove it was clear and unambiguous. The court can sit there and say, without further ado, I'll enter judgment accordingly. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, it's done. That's the story. First part of our program for today has to do with how to enforce a settlement agreement after it's been agreed upon, blessed by the court, and somebody goes ahead and ends up defaulting on it anyway. We're going to have to take a break. We're going to be back with more of Law Talk, and we're going to talk about all of these other different topics right after this.
And now, back to Law Talk on WTIC, News Talk 1080.
Okay, welcome back to Law Talk. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Glad to be with you. Even though we're here electronically, due to a scheduling issue, not live today, but we've got some great programming for you, and we hope that you stick with us right up until 1 o'clock. In the meantime, 12:30, we'll have news, sports, weather, and do everything we can to keep you up to date. Got several topics we're discussing today. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, and which you might not know if you just joined us, we are pre-recorded due to a scheduling issue, and therefore we can't take phone calls this time, but that's what we love to do. So in a future show, join us, give us a phone call. We'd love to help you on the air. Next topic for today, phrase called vexatious litigation. Sounds ominous, doesn't it? This has to do with a lawsuit brought against somebody where they don't win, and the other side says, I've incurred all of this expense. It's taken all this time, all of this indecision, apprehension. I'm suing you. And that's what's called a lawsuit based on vexatious litigation. The vexatious piece is the first lawsuit which failed. It's not the second one. It's the one that was brought. It's considered to have been vexatious if there wasn't probable cause to bring it, or for some other reason, it perhaps should not have been brought or should not have been pursued. Okay, so we've got a little vignette to illustrate this one also, and this involves Paul and Doris. And some of you are wondering, why is it that all these people have names that start with P and D? Well, plaintiff and defendant, okay? So Paul and Doris are neighbors, and I should mention that as with almost every little vignette that you hear on Law Talk, these are taken from real cases. Sometimes the names are changed to protect the innocent and the not so innocent. Sometimes they're not. But this case here, they're Paul and Doris. So they're neighbors. There's a thicket of trees on the property line that separates their property from each other. Paul thinks they're unsightly. He wants to cut them down. Doris doesn't want them cut. She likes them just the way they are. Well, Paul has them cut anyway, and that includes some trees which Doris claims are clearly on her side of the boundary line. Okay? Doris consults an attorney, and he talks with her about the tree-cutting statute. Connecticut has a statute which holds parties who cut trees on someone else's property liable for doing so. But there's a couple of exceptions, but he talks to her about the statute and about some other things. Armed with that information, Doris sues Paul. She's seeking double and treble damages and all kinds of other relief based upon that statute and some other stuff. Paul claims the suit is frivolous. He demands that she withdraw the lawsuit. Doris does not do so. She refuses. They go through an expensive trial, and each of them spend a lot of money, a lot of time. Doris loses. Okay, now step two, okay? Paul's now putting up with this. Paul now sues Doris, alleging that the pursuit of the previous lawsuit constituted vexatious litigation, and therefore he's entitled to get damages, including his expenses of defending against the vexatious, allegedly vexatious lawsuit. So here's what happens next. Doris files some defenses. And one of her defenses is that I proceeded on the basis of the advice of counsel. And remember, she did consult an attorney. So what happens here? Case number two goes to trial. And the attorney that she consulted testifies at great length. Okay. He says that he believes that Doris acted in good faith. He said that he based this advice that he gave her on the understanding she'd given him of the location of where the property lines were. And on top of that, that she had a claim under statutes regarding trespass onto her property. Now, it turns out that when the case went to trial, none of this was correct, and that's why she lost the underlying suit. So now we're in phase two, and Paul is suing to recover his damages. What's the result? Answer, you ready for this? Doris wins this time. Now, how did that happen? Well, advice of counsel is a complete defense to a vexatious lawsuit claim if, that's if, the party who's invoking that defense says that she started the lawsuit relying in good faith on the advice of an attorney, but it had to have been given within his knowledge or which he was charged with knowing. Well, what does that mean? It means that he can't just go ahead and offer an off-the-top-of-his-head opinion about something he might have studied in law school many, many years ago. If he's going to do this, he either has to know the topic or he has to agree that he will research it, find out, and then give the advice. So what are the takeaways for us on this one? Okay, first of all, the advice from the attorney, not just as a defense to vexatious litigation, but in general, if you're going to rely on it, it must not be casual or informal or cocktail party chatter, okay? Now, some of you out there are smirking and saying, so what about Law Talk? Well, listen to the end of the program. Every single show finishes with a disclaimer, tells you not to rely on this if you really want to make decisions based on it, and it tells you what to do instead. Now, the advice the attorney gives has to be something of which the lawyer has knowledge or with which he is expected to and agrees to go and obtain that knowledge. What's the word? It's the R word, research it, okay? Now, that said, the client still has to proceed acting in good faith. So here's a word to clients in a situation like this. Number one, do not rely on casual, informal advice, even if it comes from Law Talk. Okay, that's why we have the Law Talk disclaimer, and there's a good reason for that. Now, here's a word for lawyers who may be listening, because we know you're out there. Do not get trapped into giving informal advice or impressions to someone who may rely upon those. You know, that good feeling that you get from thinking you helped somebody? Well, that's going to fade really rapidly when you find out that now you're going to be a witness in a matter. You're going to be spending many, many hours working on this matter, coughing up your file, probably being deposed, probably having to testify at court, all without being paid. Because guess what? You're a fact witness. You're not testifying in any other capacity. So that's the story on vexatious litigation. We hope we've explained term, which has a mouthful of syllables. It comes up periodically, but this is intended primarily at folks who feel that they've been dragged into a lawsuit the wrong way, have prevailed, and now want to retaliate. You can do it, but watch out for that defense. This is Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Law Talk's going to return after all of this.
Back to Law Talk on WTIC, News Talk 1080.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Law Talk right here on WTIC, News Talk 1080, WTIC streaming audio on the net. As we've mentioned in the past, if you are listening locally, but you've got some friend or some family member far removed from here, just let them know that they're welcome to listen in and call in also, at least normally when we're able to take calls, but this program was pre-recorded. So how do you do that? Well, just tell them, go to WTIC.com and follow the prompts to listen live. Delighted to have them listening from wherever they are. What we're also happy to do is to let you know that if you don't have a lawyer and you're looking for some high-quality legal advice, we've got a great suggestion for you. The Hartford County Bar Association operates a not-for-profit lawyer referral service. works very simply. You phone them at the phone number that I'm going to give you in just a moment. They'll ask you a couple of questions to determine the nature of your legal inquiry, and they will refer you to an attorney that has already been vetted, who is experienced in the discipline or the part of it that you need for help with your issue, is insured, and is free of disciplinary problems, issues, or entanglements. Okay? The two questions everybody always says, all right, what do we get and what does it cost? Here's what you get. You get a half-hour consult with the attorney. You want to do it face-to-face? That's fine. You want to do it over the telephone? That's fine. You want to do it with a Zoom call? Whatever you and the attorney agree upon works fine. It's a half hour, and given the hourly rates experienced attorneys charge for their billable time, that's a pretty good chunk of time, and it's a pretty good chunk of money. But what's it cost you? It doesn't cost you their ever regular hourly rates. It's going to cost you one-time-only charge of $35, and that goes to underwrite the costs of operating this non-for-profit program. There's salaries, there's phone costs, there's rent, there's a whole bunch of things like that. Now, there's a little more to it. If you call about your workers' compensation claim, they will waive the $35 fee. If you call about your personal injury claim, no $35 fee for you either. Finally, you've got a Social Security disability claim. You call and consult them about that. That's free also. At the end of the half hour, no hard sell, no further obligation whatsoever. But if further legal services are desired or requested, you and the attorney are free to speak and discuss that together and go forward together if you wish or not. So that's how you do that, and here's how you reach them. Okay, pencils ready. 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. It's a good way to get quality, competent legal representation. Please don't hire somebody off a billboard or off an internet ad that somebody placed. This works a lot better. That's the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service at 860-525-6052. One last time, 525-6052. Okay, enough of that. Back to some of these carefully curated topics that we've selected in this pre-recorded program. This one has to do with probate, has to do in particular with wills, okay? And in this particular case, we've got a little vignette to illustrate the point, okay? Ted is an elderly widower, and he's got a few bucks. He has one son. His son is named Sammy. Sammy lives in Maine, and he seldom sees his dad, especially not up close. To say that they're estranged might be a little bit of an overstatement, but in order to say that they were close, you'd be really stretching it. Well, Ted has two nieces that live in the area. We'll call them Betty and Barbara. They're very close to Ted. They bring him home-cooked meals regularly, and as he got older, they take him to his medical appointments. He's very fond of them. Well, Ted meets his maker. He dies, as all of us must someday. He's got a will. His will leaves Sammy $1,000. All of the rest goes to Betty and Barbara. At least, that's what the copy of the will in Ted's desk drawer says. But the original cannot be found. Well, Betty and Barbara are quite thrilled. They say, well, there's a copy right here, and this is a copy of the original. It's signed, it's witnessed, it's got a self-proving affidavit, it's notarized, so we'll offer the copy, because these days everybody knows copies are all over the place. Surprise, the probate court refuses to accept it. Well, what in the world is going on? Here's what's going on. At the common law in most states, the original will has got to be produced. If it's not available, the law presumes that it's not available because the person who made it, the testator, Ted is our testator, okay, you've seen a pattern here, is presumed to have revoked the will by destroying it. But typically, when somebody signs a will, they'll have an original, they'll have a copy, their lawyer's going to have a copy. So there's copies around. But if the original is destroyed in an effort to revoke it, it's hard to chase down those copies and get all of them destroyed also. So in this particular case, Betty and Barbara are out of luck. because of the fact the original is missing and the copy is very, very favorable to them. Now, it's a presumption that the absence of the original is because it was revoked. You can rebut the presumption. And in my career, we've had a couple of opportunities where we've been able to do that. If you can show, for example, that there are facts consistent with the will not having been intentionally revoked. One of them involved somebody who had moved, left a box of records behind to be picked up later, forgot about it, and they were ultimately discarded by the next occupant of the house. And there was enough evidence to show that the court could conclude that's what happened. So the copy did get admitted. Short of that, that's not going to happen because of this presumption. Okay? So now, in this particular fact pattern, Sammy the son is the next of kin. Ted did not have a previous will that he did before the one leaving everything to Betty and Barbara. So Sammy is his next of kin. He's an only child. Ted's wife had died many years before because, as I mentioned, he's a widower. Even with the copy of the will that gave Sammy a pittance and everything else to his cousins, Betty and Barbara, Sammy would have still stood to inherit everything from Ted's estate, because without a valid will, you go by what's called the laws of intestate succession. So that's what happened here. What is the takeaway on this one? Number one, take very, very good care of the original will. Number two, if you are going to revoke a will, the best way to do it is to do it in the lawyer's presence, because they're going to end up doing a new will or a codicil, the language of which is going to take care of that. So there's no question whatsoever that that is what you intended to do. And that's our piece for this. That's our segment for this piece. We're going to have to break for some commercials and some other similar items. And we're going to be back after that. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Last piece of Law Talk for today coming up right after this.
To Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Okay, here we are back at Law Talk on a Saturday afternoon, heading right up to 1 o'clock. I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Glad that you're with us. In case you're just dialing in, this program had to be pre-recorded, therefore cannot take phone calls today. Love to talk to you on a future show. We are here Saturdays from noon until 1 o'clock Eastern Time. Segment that we wanted to discuss that I talked about earlier, following up with the business about the wills, thought we'd stay in the realm of probate. We're going to be talking about buying an asset from mom's estate, okay? There's a couple of things tricky about it, and if you're not the one buying it, there's a couple of things to watch out for. So here's the example. Mom's a widower. She dies, and she owns the family home where she lived until the time of her death. And she's got three daughters, okay? Two of them are well settled in their own homes. They don't really have an interest in mom's home. The third daughter, unfortunately, things are not quite as settled. Life hasn't been quite as fortunate for her. There's been a failed marriage. There's been some financial difficulties. She's no longer in a home. She's in an apartment. And even though she's now got pretty good employment, she's sort of pining for a home. And she realizes that mom's home is going to be sold. So she goes to her two sisters and she says, "What's going to happen to the house?" And they say, "Well, you know, under mom's will, the three of us are going to inherit the house, but we don't want it, and so I guess it's got to be sold. What do you think?" And she said, "Well, I'd like to buy it." So a discussion ensues, and here's what the parties agree upon. They get an appraisal or a comparative market analysis from a real estate agent. For our purposes, either one will work. And they conclude that the house is worth $300,000. And that's a number that's selected because it's divisible by three by your host. No other magic to it, okay? And so our beneficiary here agrees that she's going to buy the house for $300,000. And her sisters shrug their shoulders and they agree. And then she says to them, But because I'm going to be inheriting this house, or one third of it, just like the two of you are, what I'd like to do is to pay $200,000 for it instead of having to pay $300,000. Much easier payments, easier to get the mortgage, and so on. So the two of them say that, well, okay, sounds good to us. So they go ahead and they do a closing, and the estate sells the house to the daughter for $200,000, okay? Now, what's happened here is that the law considers this discount of one-third equal to a partial advance distribution of the estate. Why is that important? Well, here's why it's important. Because now the house is sold and she's happily ensconced in the family home, and despite and in addition to bringing back all kinds of memories and fond thoughts, she's now making it her own and she's got some stability. So it's time to wrap up the estate, and there's a final accounting financial report that's distributed, and it shows all of the estate assets, including the net proceeds from the sale of the house, being divided equally among the three of them, just like the will says. And so she sees the accounting and she says, well, what's wrong with that? She thinks it's fine. The other two sisters, totally different attitude. They both object, saying that this is unfair and incorrect. What are they talking about? Okay. Remember that we were discussing just a moment ago the business that this is an advanced distribution. The way that final account should read is that the three of them end up dividing equally the net assets of the estate after expenses among the three of them in equal shares, except for the net proceeds from the sale of the house. And why is that? I mean, there's three of them. It's because they sold it to their sister for a one-third discount. In other words, she got an advance distribution of her share of the estate. If everything that was left, including the net proceeds, was divided equally among the three of them, she'd be basically getting a distribution twice with respect to the value of the house. So the accounting ends up having to be changed. And what happens is that the house is treated separately. Everything else in there, the bank accounts, the mutual funds, the securities, bonds, whatever else mom has that belongs to the estate, the net proceeds can be divided equally. But with respect to the net proceeds from the sale of the house, $200,000, the two other sisters each end up getting $100,000, and our new homeowner gets zero out of that proceeds. So here's the takeaway on that. Number one, if you are in the position of the buyer of this house, don't hesitate to ask for a reduction on the purchase price. It's a great deal because you're going to pay much less for the property. It'll be easier to get the mortgage. Your monthly payments will probably be less because the mortgage will be smaller. But the flip side of that coin is, don't be surprised if there's a reduction in your distribution that you'd otherwise be entitled to, equal to the amount of the break that you were given off the fair market value of the house. Now, the point for the other two sisters is, if you agree to something like this, remember that unless you want your sister to be paid twice, the accounting that's going to be approved is going to split the net proceeds between the two of you, and she's not going to be entitled to a third of $200,000. She's already gotten one third of $300,000 to get to the two. So there's a little practical thing that comes up, and it sort of leads to another topic that's related, and that is whether the house should be sold by the estate or whether it should be distributed to the three sisters, and then sisters A and B sell their interest to sister C after they've taken title in their own names. This is often driven by tax considerations, and here's what I mean by that, okay? The fair market value of this house at the time of mom's death is reported in the inventory of the estate. Now, depending on the market and depending on how long it takes to sell it, there may be a significant change in that fair market value. If you go through the sort of real estate market that we've gone through the last couple of years, there may be a significant uptick in the space of 12, 15, 18 months in there. So somebody is going to end up with a capital gain, whether it's the estate, which means the capital gain is going to be shared by all the beneficiaries, or whether it is the individuals to whom the asset is distributed who are going to be paying it individually. You see what I mean? If the estate pays it, it's shared by all, whereas if the property is already distributed, now it's going to be the tax responsibility of Sister A and Sister B. The magic clock here is telling me that another Law Talk is coming to a close. Sorry that we weren't able to be with you in person. Glad to have you listening. Thanks very much to Joey and Anthony and the producers that took this and put it together. If it sounds good, they get the credit. Otherwise, it's all on me. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar, and we'll see ya.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.